Okay, I went ahead and muted everybody's line. What I'm going to talk about first is really just kind of give a general overview of where we're at and what has been going on for the past couple of months in the market and in the economy. And then I'm going to go ahead and talk about where it is perhaps that we're going. So to go ahead and just remind everybody why I do these types of calls, we're going to go ahead and do these a little bit more regularly. As most of you know, we do a forecast past and present in January and then a mid-year market update in July. Over the past couple of years, I've done a few of these calls kind of sporadically. We did a ton of them towards the end of 2008 as the financial crisis was unfolding. But what I'm going to be doing now is holding a conference call just like this around this time each year and then again in around the October time frame. That way, it will give us an opportunity to give these general overviews about four times a year in total. And I like to do these because, first of all, I want you guys to know what I'm thinking. I also like to try to filter out a lot of the noise that we all hear out there. And I also like to put a lot of things into perspective for my clients as well. Certainly what we're dealing with right now is a very, very complex market and a somewhat unstable market. We have had, as everybody knows, unconventional government intervention over the past 3 years, from Freddie and Fannie basically being overtaken by the government, to the bank bailouts, to TARP, to stimulus, to the Federal Reserve with their quantitative easing programs. We are really being set up right now for a very unstable market. That doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have a dramatic sell-off. There's just a lot of uncertainty because we've never been down this road before. I've talked to most of you during our meetings, really communicating with you that we need to remember that there is no free lunch. What the government has been doing over the past couple of years will have consequences at some point. How negative those consequences will be, nobody knows. We might just have mild, somewhat subdued growth for the foreseeable future. We might have another downturn in the next 6 to 18 months. We really don't know how all of this is going to be playing out because, we've never been down this road before. The market over the past year or so has been quite volatile. It was about a year ago this time when the market for the year was up about 8% or so. Many of you might remember we had about a two-month period where the market went up, boy, what seemed to be almost every single day. And then May rolled around, and we had a 17% pullback, and that was also the time when we had the flash crash, when the market went down intraday just over 1,000 points. So within about a six-week period, we went from the market being up for the year about 8.5% to being down about 9%. Interesting enough, that was also the time period where the Federal Reserve was stopping their quantitative easing program, part one. So the market kind of struggled for the next few months, and then we all remember at the end of August, they announced quantitative easing part two, and of course the market has been rallying since then. Over the past couple of months, since February 21st of this year, the market is actually still down during that time period. The market is up for the year so far because we had a really nice run-up in the market in January, but believe it or not, over the past couple of months, the market is still slightly down since February 21st. And you can look at that one of two ways. You could say, well, boy, that's really a positive because we've had a lot of negative news out there with higher oil, higher food, and the unrest in the Middle East. Or you could look at that as being a real negative, saying, well, boy, we've had this wonderful earnings news here lately. You know, why can't the market get a little bit higher and gain some traction? Well, we all know that markets don't go up in a straight line, and they generally don't go down in a straight line either. So, again, I kind of look at this as to what's happened over the past couple of months with all of the headline news out there, and I really look at all of this as this being, at least for right now, more of a positive than a negative. Many of you guys probably saw in the news on Monday, Standard & Poor's gave the U.S. credit market a negative outlook. They switched the outlook from stable to negative. That probably doesn't come as a very big surprise to most Americans. Yes, we do have way too much debt. We have had way too much debt for a very, very long time now. The stock market reacted by having a fairly dramatic sell-off, but oddly enough, the bond market reacted and they rallied. Interest rates actually dropped a little bit after that report. Conventional wisdom may have said, well, boy, shouldn't rates have gone up? If there's a lot of fear about what might happen to our debt in the bond market, wouldn't have a lot of people been selling their bonds? Well, no. I mean, it actually turned out to be the exact opposite. And that could potentially be due to the fact that if S&P down or changes the outlook on our debt from stable to negative, that could provide more incentive to Congress to actually try and get something done to help reduce our deficits. Because now Congress can, you know, it's always challenging as a politician, I'm sure, to make these very difficult decisions. But now they also have it in their back pocket that, hey, S&P has actually come out and changed their outlook on us from stable to negative. We cannot afford to go down that road. So this might really force Congress and allow Congress to make those very difficult decisions and really begin to try to rein in the deficits, which could in turn create a stronger dollar, at least during that time, which could even have a trickle down to hurting commodities, which I'm going to talk about in just a few moments. So the bond market has actually been quite stable over the past several weeks, but leaning towards the side of rallying. We had the Japanese earthquake happen, boy, was this now about 6 weeks or so ago. Believe it or not, when that happened, the market had already begun to sell off a little bit. And, certainly we can't talk enough about the tragedy that has happened over there. When it did occur, the market sold off even more, and then within a matter of a few days, it actually stabilized quite dramatically and began to move up a little bit. We've had ongoing tension in the Middle East. That's been going on now for a couple of months. When this actually started over in Egypt, some of you may remember we had a Friday afternoon when this really broke, and the market went down dramatically. The market was down almost 200 points or so. That was on a Friday. Monday and Tuesday of the following week, the market rallied and actually made all of those points back again. So the market really absorbed a lot of the tensions that were occurring over in Egypt. The market got a little bit more uneasy with all of the tensions going on in Libya. And, of course, during this time, we've also seen the price of oil increase. I think, you know, we can point to the price of oil going up primarily for two reasons. Number one, the quantitative easing program that was put in place, or at least that was announced in September by the Federal Reserve, really goes to help weaken our dollar, which will in turn strengthen the value of commodities because they are valued in U.S. dollars. And now also since that time, we've had the unrest in the Middle East, which has also led to higher oil prices because we've had greater uncertainty. But the market during this time has been very, very resilient. We have oil right now at just over $110 a barrel. So I think that certainly we can look at the market reactions to these events over the past couple of months as being quite positive. Even though we're ever so slightly down since February, it's nothing dramatic. We've heard a lot in the news lately about the debate on the debt ceiling. Let's wait and see what Congress is going to do. I still believe they're going to come to some type of compromise or agreement. But also the rhetoric over the past several days has certainly grown a little bit more tense. So we don't know what is ultimately going to happen with the debt ceiling. And, of course, with the deficit, we'll see if Congress truly will listen to the American people and, of course, to Standard & Poor's as well to try to get our act together here. I think the good thing that has been happening regarding our deficit is the conversations that have been taking place. Now, maybe they haven't been civil between the Democrats and the Republicans, but at least there's a conversation. There's a debate among our elected officials and Americans in general. This is such a priority for Americans and for America to get our deficits under control. Let's also remember, though, that whatever it is that hopefully eventually gets done regarding deficit reduction, it's not going to be easy, because any significant cuts will affect people. You can look across the board. Everything that they've talked about cutting will have an effect on people. There is no free lunch out there. So whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, defense, or numerous other programs, anything that does get cut will have an effect on people. Neither side really seems to be embracing too much of the Simpson-Bowles proposal, yet they each talk about using it as a framework for their own budget proposals. Certainly, I'm hopeful that they're going to be able to come up with some type of compromise with trying to reduce the deficit, and I remain cautiously optimistic that will ultimately happen. I think that if President Obama were to get reelected, I do think he would look at cutting some spending coupled with raising taxes, while I think if the Republicans won, they would probably have more of a mandate to really go in there and go ahead and dramatically cut spending. They've made it pretty clear that they don't want to go back in and raise taxes. Of course, one never knows what will ultimately happen. So I think either way, we are heading down a course of some type of deficit reduction. Keeping in mind, once again, part of GDP, part of our gross domestic product, is government spending. So when you begin to take out government spending, that does have an impact on our economic growth. So over the short term, that would be a negative. But over the long term, it is absolutely necessary and should be a long-term positive. The UK have put in austerity measures now for the better part of the past 6 to 12 months or so. And they had a haircut on their GDP to the tune of about 0.5%, which oddly enough is about the amount of government spending that was reduced over there. So again, I'm cautiously optimistic that we will begin to put some of the necessary steps in, hopefully all of them, to really begin to reduce our deficit. The bond market so far this year has really stabilized. Most of you remember around the fourth quarter of last year, we had a spike up in interest rates. The fears came back again about, oh my goodness, interest rates are going to go through the roof. We're going to have runaway inflation, et cetera. We made a couple of changes in the portfolios in December to try to insulate your portfolios in the event we do see rising interest rates. We still don't want to completely abandon bonds, because you always have to look at what the alternative to that is. Do we want to put all of your money now in commodities or all of it into stocks? We don't want to lose sight of the fact that those types of investments, as we've learned over the past 10 years, they do not come without risk. So there are very different types of bonds out there. It's a $90 trillion market. We did make some adjustments in the event we do see rising rates. But really, since that time, interest rates have come down. We have a 10-year bond right now that is all the way back down to 3.39%. It got as high as about 3.75% just a few months ago. Right now, certainly the talk and the threat of inflation and rising interest rates have been all over the news, but they've also been all over the news for the better part of 2 years now. I think one exercise that we can all do to perhaps try to guess where things may go is to ask yourself where you think inflation will go, where you think interest rates will go, and then ask five of your friends where they think interest rates will go and where they think inflation will go. And if you all come to an agreement on it and you all agree where all of those things are headed, chances are it will go the other way. And we have been in a period now where the talk of inflation has been on the forefront, and it has now only really been over the past couple of months where we have seen signs of inflation. However, we need to take a step back and remember what type of inflation we're referring to. Everybody on this call, we are all fighting higher prices at the gas pump and at the grocery store. That is one area of inflation. The unfortunate thing about our current economic state is that we don't really have high core inflation. Core inflation is the inflation that is in our economy excluding food and energy. Well, when you include food and energy, we certainly have inflation. But everybody, all of us, we're all, you know, we drive cars, we ride airplanes. Oil and energy affects our economy greatly. So we're all paying higher prices at the pump. We're all paying higher prices at the supermarket. We are absolutely feeling the effects of things. But core inflation, believe it or not, is still relatively flat. Well, what are some of the areas that make up core inflation? Leisure, you know, when you go travel, you go stay in a hotel, you go take, not your actual travel plans, but where you're actually staying. Housing. Housing is a big part of the inflation index. And housing for most people is the biggest asset that they have. And housing continues to either flatline or slightly deflate. Wages are another big piece of the inflation index, and wages have actually been flatlined to slightly down for the better part of 10 years. And there is still no real signs that wages are increasing. One of the reasons, and people may wonder this, well, why does the Federal Reserve not completely look at food and energy? Why do they sometimes exclude food and energy? The reason why they do that is because prices for food and energy can fluctuate dramatically over a very short period of time. If you were to have a drought, that's going to affect food prices, but it would probably only affect food prices for maybe that 3 to 6 month period or so. Energy can go up and down dramatically as well over a very short period of time. It was only a few years ago when the price of oil was trading at about $150 a barrel. Many of you probably remember this. There was a lot of talk about oil was going to go to $200 and $250 a barrel. Well, within about 3 months of those conversations, oil was all the way back down to $65 a barrel. So energy and food can be quite volatile, which again is one of the reasons why the federal government looks at both areas of inflation. They have real inflation and they have core inflation. So certainly all of us are feeling the effects of core inflation because of gas prices and higher food prices, but we still have housing that is in real trouble, and we also have people's wages that are certainly not inflationary. Let's also keep in mind that recessions, by definition, are deflationary. So going back to 2008, when the price of oil was at $150, the scare was that it was going to go up to $200 or $250. We, of course, go into a dramatic recession. Price of oil comes all the way down. Well, you know, why does that happen? Well, when you go into recession, demand goes down dramatically. So if the demand is not there, most likely the pricing power is going to go down as well. So we are certainly seeing really a tug of war going on right now on the inflation side of things. Because like I said before, you do have certain areas of the economy that are really inflating quite dramatically. But then you have other areas that continue to flatline, if not go down a little bit. The bond market right now could be telling us that we could be seeing some headwinds here. Why has the 10-year bond rallied here over the past several weeks? We would all think it would do the exact opposite. Well, it's possible that the bond market is foretelling something that will take place over the next 3, 6, 9 months, equating to some type of economic slowdown. The Federal Reserve's quantitative easing program is set to expire in June. Nobody knows what they're going to do at that time. Will they embark on a QE3 or will they end it at QE2? We'll know that. We'll know a little bit more probably next week when the Federal Reserve has their next meeting, but there has certainly been several hints dropped that they will not continue on with another quantitative easing program. Those programs were set in place to have the Federal Reserve buy U.S. Treasury bonds. with the hope and the desire that they would keep interest rates low. Well, oddly enough, when they embarked on QE1, interest rates went up. When they embarked on QE2, when it actually went in, interest rates went up. If you remember, that was the spike up in the fourth quarter of last year. Oddly enough, when they stopped QE1, interest rates came down. And there's speculation here that if they stop QE2, that interest rates might not actually spike up, but they could actually come down. And why would that be the case? Well, potentially the market could be worried that we could be hitting another slowdown if they don't do another quantitative easing program. So if we embark on an economic slowdown, that could be strong for bonds. Also, if the Federal Reserve is not going to be pumping a lot of money into the economy, that could help thwart off inflation. If there's not a high threat of inflation, we probably won't see interest rates go up. So there are a lot of things at play here right now, and certainly we're going to know a lot more over the next couple of months. What are some of the cons right now that are going on out there in the market and the economy as of right now? Certainly rising price of oil. It seems as though we as consumers and we as businesses have been able to absorb these higher prices, but this won't be able to go on for an indefinite period of time. So rising oil prices certainly will act as a headwind. We've had several economists come out and lower their forecast for GDP, which is a little unsettling only because we've had so much government stimulus and intervention, yet we still have relatively weak economic growth. The good thing is at least we've had growth, and we've had growth now for the better part of a year and a half, and that's a very, very good thing. But one of the cons right now is we are seeing some revisions down for GDP. We still have a weak housing market. I've talked about this for a long time now, for the better part of 2 years. I felt as though we would begin the bottoming process in housing about a year ago, and I think that that is still probably pretty accurate. But I think that the bottoming process for housing will take a couple of years. So we're by no means out of the woods, and I think it's going to be another 5 to 10 years until we really see the housing market begin to see upticks. Okay, certainly we want to see it stop going down and flatline, but I think we're going to be looking at many, many, many years until we begin to see an uptick. Look at the technology industry. The tech bubble burst in 2000. Here we are in 2011, and we're really just now seeing over the past 12 months or so technology companies really leading the way. Another con is government spending cuts. Again, over the long term, boy, this is such a positive, but over the short term, this will create a drag on economic growth. And, of course, we have the ongoing high unemployment rate. So there are several cons out there, but there are also a lot of pros. Number one, we have higher industrial production. That is very, very positive. We have very, very strong corporate profits. Companies are making money. This is definitely the biggest pro out there. At the end of the day, what drives stock prices, bond prices, commodity prices? It's supply and demand. If more people want to buy something, the price is going to go up. Well, people are going to want to buy the stock of companies that are growing and making money. Companies right now are making money. The earnings reports have been absolutely spectacular. So we can certainly look at some of the negatives that I just laid out for you, but we absolutely have to look at the driving positive force here, and that is that companies continue to drive earnings higher. We've had great news out over the past couple of days. We had a huge rally yesterday. We had more good news this morning on the earnings front. The market is up again today, but we're not seeing nearly the rally that we saw yesterday. In fact, GE came out with some really good earning news, and believe it or not, they're down 2% today. So we need to take a step back and think, well, does that mean that a lot of the good news has been baked into the cake for companies like GE? It's quite possible, but I can tell you that right now corporate profits are very, very strong. The balance sheets of so many companies in corporate America are as strong as they have ever been. So that is absolutely terrific news. On a technical basis, the market is still fairly strong. So there are certainly a lot of positives right now for the market. Okay, where are we going? Well, I think the story of deleveraging is still out there on the forefront. Been talking about this for a couple of years. You know, when we talk about deficit reduction, that's deleveraging. We're going to be trying to reduce our spending, reduce our debts. The American household, the consumer, they have been trying to do that over the past couple of years, but we certainly have a ways to go. We've had mixed news about housing foreclosures and delinquencies. I've been talking about that for some time. It does seem as though with all of the problems with the mortgage documentation that came out, oh boy, what was that, about 6 months or so ago, that a lot of foreclosures have kind of been swept under the rug and they have not really been processed. But the housing market continues to be a significant drag and probably will be for quite some time. Where are we going on the inflation-deflation front? I just talked about that a few minutes ago. Certainly, with food and energy, the things that affect everybody on this call on a day-to-day basis, prices continue to inflate. If we see the economy continue to grow, even at this small pace, we could see these prices continue to go up. So we have to be very cognizant of that. But unfortunately, we also have to keep our eye on deflation still when it comes to the housing market. We still have high unemployment. It's hard to get runaway inflation when you have high level of unemployment. And, of course, wages staying stagnant will also put a drag on the economy and really not force us into a period of time when we have high inflation. So, you know, really who's getting squeezed in all of this? It's all of us on the call. It's middle America. It's people that are not making any more money today than they did a few years ago. Stock market is flat to down from where it was several years ago. Yet the price of what we're paying in the supermarket and at the gas pump is dramatically higher. Where are we going in relation to bonds right now? There's been some talk about a bond bubble. I've made it pretty clear what my opinion is on that. I don't think we're in a bond bubble. I don't think bonds are priced to do particularly well over the next 5 to 10 years. I'm certainly in that camp. But like I said earlier, the price of securities don't go up in a straight line and they don't go down in a straight line. The reason why I don't think we're in a bond bubble and that we're going to see it burst, number one, is if everybody thinks we're in one, we're probably not. But number two, normally bubbles are born out of high levels of leverage. When you just look back over the last 11 years, the tech boom that we saw, there was a tremendous amount of leverage at that time, and a tremendous amount of investors were investing with a lot of leverage. There were many people that would come into my office saying, Jonathan, I'm considering taking out a home equity line, taking out 100 grand, and going ahead and buying a tech stock. What do you think? Well, I think all of you on the call know what I would say about that, but that just goes to show what was going on at that point. It was such a bubble. It was such a frenzy during that time, and of course the bubble burst. During the Great Recession and the credit crisis, this was really brought about by excess leverage. So generally, you're going to have bubbles created when you have excess leverage. I don't know of anybody going out there creating leverage to try to get into the bond market. So while I'm certainly in the camp that we have to keep a very watchful eye on bonds and interest rates, I don't believe bonds will provide a compelling value, U.S. bonds, mind you, U.S. bonds, over the next 5 to 10 years. There will be pockets and periods in which we'll want to own them. But we also always have to look at what the alternative is at that time. So I don't anticipate a bond bubble, or at least I don't see one right now. If we do see a slowdown in the economy over the next 6 to 12 months, you'll probably see interest rates, at least on the 10-year bond, stay where they are. In fact, they could even come back down a little bit. Where are we going again? The end of quantitative easing is around the corner. We shall see what the Federal Reserve will actually end up doing. In the month of July, that starts the fiscal year for state and local governments, and we've seen in the news that they are going to be instilling large amounts of spending cuts, and that could potentially take a bite out of economic activity. And of course, at the end of the year, we also have the payroll tax cut that will be ending, and that on average has given working Americans a tax break of about $1,000. And again, that is set to expire at the end of December. So we're really setting ourselves up now over the next couple of months for even more uncertainty. Like I said earlier, the market rallied last year after the Fed announced their quantitative easing program part two, and we had a huge sell-off in the middle of the year when QE1 came to an end, and we were kind of forced to stand more on our own 2 feet. Again, where are we going? Based on forward-looking estimates for the stock market, because we all hear this on the news, on the radio, et cetera, you can talk to 10 different analysts and you're going to get 10 different opinions on the market. Some people will tell you that the market looks cheap right now. Well, those people are looking at what's called forward-looking estimates. They're looking at what the estimates are for earnings in the future. Of course, we don't know what the future holds. Nobody does. They're just estimates for what they think it will be. When you look at forward earnings estimates, right now, the average estimate out there is for S&P earnings to be right around $99 or so. When you use that number, you have a market that is fairly priced to maybe even being somewhat undervalued. The only problem is that if you have a hiccup in the economy or these companies don't reach their earning numbers, you could immediately be looking at a dramatically overvalued market. But for right now, if you're looking at forward-looking numbers, the market looks reasonably valued. If you look back and you take average earnings over the trailing 10 years to smooth out earnings estimates, you have a market that some could argue is anywhere from 25 to 40% overvalued. Now, what we all must remember as investors is this, that markets can stay overvalued for a very long period of time. Markets can also stay undervalued for a very, very long period of time. So we don't want to get too caught up on whether or not we think the market is under or overvalued. It's certainly a consideration, but keep in mind the market is going to do what it's going to do. And like I said, it can stay overvalued for a long time, as we learned in the late 90s, and it can stay undervalued for a very long time, as we learned in the late 70s and in the early 80s. As of right now, we have our client portfolios positioned, I think, quite appropriately. Our conservative clients on the line, we do have some exposure to equities, but because you're conservative, we don't have a lot in there, but we do have a little bit because the market has been strong. The technicals right now are relatively strong. Companies are making money. Our more moderate clients, we're taking a pretty constructive position right now. We're about 50-50 between equities and bonds, which I think is really a great place to be given the market strength that we've seen over the past 4 to 5 months, but also given all of the uncertainty that we've seen and the dramatic run-up that we've seen in the market over the past 2 years, really an unprecedented run-up. For our clients that are a little bit more aggressive, we're about 60% invested, not quite to where we would be in a more normal environment, but nevertheless, I think the current positioning of the portfolios are allowing us to take advantage of some of the upswings in the market while offering some element of protection on the downside. The only thing that is going wrong that I can see right now in our client portfolios is one investment that we have. All the investments that we have for virtually all of you are doing exactly what we want them to be doing. For their particular asset class, they're really performing well. The only one that has been underperforming is the Fairhome Fund. Many of you on the phone here hear me talk about that fund. You've owned it for a long time. We've made a lot of money on it. Bruce Berkowitz is the manager of that fund. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because for so far in the year, he's dramatically underperforming the market, but I want to tell everybody why, and I want to tell you what we're doing about it. We've owned Fairhome now for several years. The fund has been around since 1999. Bruce Berkowitz is the manager of the fund. He just won Fund Manager of the Decade just a few months ago. Certainly not a dumb guy. During 2008, his fund was down 28%. Not bad considering the market was down 38%. In 2009, he was up 39%. And just last year in 2010, the guy was up 24%. Market was only up 12%. last year. He has been an absolute stellar manager. Unfortunately, so far for the year, his fund is down a little bit more than 3%, which does not sit well when you have a market that is up for the year, especially because we do have relatively high exposure to the Fairholme. So on one breath, we don't want to just, you know, throw them out of the car saying, well, you know, you're underperforming. I mean, we are, after all, only about 3.5 months into the year. Every manager is going to underperform at certain points. He has far and away trounced the market over the past 3, 5, and 10 years. But we can't ignore the fact that there is underperformance. The reason I can tell you, by the way, why there is underperformance is because he has a high allocation to financials. He believes financials right now are grossly, grossly undervalued and inexpensive. And he's willing to be, obviously, a little bit early to the party if it means stronger returns later on. So we don't know ultimately what will happen in financials. He still has a strong allocation to there. But I am looking closely right now at reducing our allocation to Fairholme and moving it over into another equity fund. The one thing that could work against us is he has since raised his minimum investment account, and there's been a lot of speculation that he could be closing the fund. So there is a big part of me that doesn't want to make a knee-jerk reaction just because he's been slightly underperforming for 3.5 months if it means that we might not be able to get back in 6 to 12 or 18 months from now. So I just wanted to let everybody know that this is front and center on my radar screen. It's actually been on my radar screen for about the past 2 months or so, and that is really the only investment that I can point to in any of your accounts that is showing some underperformance. So I just want to keep everybody up to date on that we might be making some changes there. And with that, I am going to go ahead and open it up to Q&A. Let me go ahead and unmute everybody. Okay, everybody's unmuted. Well, I went on a little bit longer than I thought, but some of you are not surprised by that probably, so I apologize for running a little bit over. I'm going to go ahead and open it up to Q&A. Anybody like to ask any questions, just go ahead and fire away. Any questions out there for me?
Jonathan?
Yeah.
On a relatively conservative portfolio, what should the allocation be right now between bonds and stocks?
Well, we're
say that again. I know you covered it briefly in your discussion.
Well, Josh, I think, you know, for me, when I'm having conversations with clients and I say, okay, you're conservative, and a conservative client for me is a client that comes to me and says, Jonathan, look, I understand markets go up or down, but you know, I cannot stand to see my portfolio go down, you know, much more than 5-10%. I just, at any given time, I just can't stomach that. Well, in that regard, you're going to be a conservative investor. You don't want to see really any of those wild fluctuations. So for right now, you'd be right around that 20-ish percent range between equities and then bonds. But we'd also have some commodities sprinkled in there as well to the tune of about 5%. But again, all bonds are not created equal. So some of the bonds that are in the portfolio can be invested a little bit more aggressively to have a look a little bit more like equities, just not quite the same level of volatility.
Okay.
And we do have, if you guys looked at your portfolios, you have a unique set of fixed income assets in there. Many of them are somewhat uncorrelated to interest rates, or to interest rates going up. So if interest rates were to go up, some of the holdings that we have in there will hold up quite well. And we also have a relatively high amount of foreign bond exposure as well. So again, not all bonds are created equal.
Thank you.
Sure thing. What other questions are out there? I know there got to be some.
Couldn't be we're the only two people on the phone, could it?
I wouldn't think so. I heard a lot of beeping going on before that call started. I guess we have a lot of shy people on the phone today. Well, maybe I just spoke for so long that I answered all of the questions that you had, or everybody fell asleep. Well, all right, guys. Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up then. If there are no other questions, please remember our door is always open. We are here to serve you. Any questions you have, issues, concerns, anything that we're doing that you have a question on, please don't hesitate to give us a call. If you have any questions about what I went over on this call, please don't hesitate to call us again. I do want to thank all of you guys for your trust, your loyalty, and your support, and we look forward to speaking with you guys very shortly. Bye-bye.